Hi, everybody. We're glad you're here today. I'm Leslie Herrenkohl, and I'm a professor here at the University of Washington. And we were asked to give a little bit more detailed background, so I think Lindsay and I will go ahead and do that each in turn, kind of think a little bit about how we got into our area of interest and research that we'll be talking about today. So I think it's fair to say that I've always been interested in learning, and I've always been interested in language and culture, and spent time as a high school student in Japan as an exchange student. But I kind of never thought that those things would go together. So as an undergraduate student, kind of explored them separately. And it wasn't until I came across the work of Jim Wirch, who seemed to be bringing culture, language, and learning and development, human development, together in new ways for me, that it opened up a whole new world of possibilities to bridge these interests. And so I pursued my graduate work in developmental psychology with Jim at Clark University, and then went on to do a postdoc with Anne-Marie Palinsar at the University of Michigan to gain even more experience in educational settings. I've always been interested in science, so that was a logical kind of disciplinary focus for me. And I've always enjoyed documenting how people learn and the design of learning environments to support powerful learning that is equitable and intellectually rigorous. So I started my graduate career working on those things and have continued through my years as an assistant professor and associate professor and now full professor here at the University of Washington. So I'll turn it over to you, Lindsay.
Okay. So I'm Lindsay Cornelius, and I'm a former PhD doctorate student here at the University of Washington. You'll just have to bear with me in my voice today. I'm kind of getting over a cold, so I'll hang in as much as I can and maybe turn over to Leslie if I run out of voice at some point. But my interest in learning, I trace back to my experiences with my nephew when he was born. I was 18 years old, and watching him learn as an infant really sparked my interest in, wow, how can we capture the natural desire of young children to learn and to grow and just use that all through their schooling experiences? And so that was what brought me from a background in psychology to the University of Washington to study with Leslie, with interests such as participation and engagement. And right after I started my graduate career here, I got involved with a project that we'll be discussing today called Promoting Argumentation. And from there, I developed my interests and expertise in areas of inquiry in the disciplines, working with Leslie on understanding how identity develops through these experiences, how discourse shapes these experiences. But just through my graduate experiences, developed an interest and concern with issues of equity and social justice, which actually took me to where I am today, which is as a classroom teacher. So after I finished my PhD, I got my master's in teaching, which I had not been a teacher before, and I am currently a brand new teacher in an elementary school teaching math. And so I'm working at merging research and practice in my own daily life and hopefully continuing to contribute to the literature and learning sciences.
That's really interesting that you've gone from a PhD to the classroom. We often get people going the other way. Be really interesting for you to start doing some action research. Before we get going into the presentation, I wanted to give Demetrio a chance to introduce himself and let people say hi. He didn't hit to join the queue, so he kind of dropped off the radar screen for me. I apologize for that. So, Demetrio, if you will click join the queue, then when I come off, you'll come on. Okay, so Demetrios, we cannot hear you. So when you have a question or if you have a comment to make, you should type it into the chat box and I will voice it, okay? All right, so I'm going to stop broadcasting and have Leslie and Lindsay move ahead with their presentation. I assume we're supposed to go to the first slide.
Thanks, Susan. Yes, if everybody can pull up the slide, that would be really helpful because we'll use those as a guide for the work that we do today. And so if we can turn to page 2, so the slides are also numbered. You'll see in the bottom right-hand corner, each slide should have a number, and we'll refer to those numbers throughout the time that we're talking today, so you know where to locate us in the presentation. Before we get started, one of the things I wanted to mention is that Lindsay and I are definitely willing and able to provide access to the paper that was the primary kind of focal paper for today's discussion. It is a relatively recent Journal of the Learning Sciences article, and we hope that people have had access to that. If you don't, please email us. We'd be happy to provide access to you at this time. And we really appreciate Susan and Frank and others and their patience with us in wanting to move forward with talking about this particular paper. There's both a process story about the paper itself that would be interesting to tell as time goes on in the presentation and as we have a chance to do that. But it's also, I think, just a good representation of how we've wrestled with a complex data set and feel like we understand better as a result how people learn, especially within these particular disciplinary contexts. But before we get started, we thought it would be really interesting to know from all of you what disciplinary expertise you bring to the conversation today. So on page 2, we've asked you to think about a few questions. What disciplines do you consider to be areas of expertise, and some examples of things that you know or do as a part of your work in that field, and then reflect on how you learned those things. So we're going to give people a few minutes to reflect if you're on your own or if you are with other people. Maybe you want to share in pairs. And then use the chat window to tell us what kinds of expertise do all of you bring to the conversation today. Wow, it looks like we have quite a range of expertise today on the webinar. It's very interesting for us to see this. I don't know if anybody feels like they want to share how they learned to do these things that they count as areas of expertise, but we'd love to see and hear about those things, maybe from at least 2 groups or something. How did you learn how to do what you consider to be an area of expertise, either if it's knowledge or a practice? How'd you learn?
So I'm going to start with mathematics, as I know there's no other mathematician around here at the moment. So I guess you start learning mathematics quite intuitively or with artifacts, like you have 1 brick, 2 bricks, 3 bricks, and so on. And after this more intuitive, playful beginning, it's lots and lots about practicing, about stating why you're allowed to do something and not allowed to do something else, why 6 plus 5 is 11 and not something else. And it's lots of practice at the end.
Thanks, Daniel. That was really terrific. I think you shared some really interesting things for us, and I'm hoping somebody else might be willing to share. I see that Susan in the chat has also said that through formal training and years of experience doing it and mentoring others and apprenticing them into it. Does any other group want to share how they learned?
Would you talk?
Oh, you want me to? Okay. Talking about Aikido, so that's the martial arts that's listed there, and it started with just joining a school and taking classes as a beginner, and there were sort of we had ranks to go through, and so you had things that you had to learn and know how to do for those ranks, but then on top of that, there was also just coming to class every day, and coming to class as often as possible, and then we'd also talk about the art, like when we'd all go out to dinner, or there'd be like seminars, and then we'd have community events, and you learned a lot from just listening to other people who've been doing it for a while.
Yoga had a similar path, except I lived with my teacher and learned through apprenticeship by living in a yoga center for a while, a residential center, and then went out and started teaching and continued my own practice.
Well, it seems like there are some themes that have emerged, right, from our conversations. And I think that one of the things that we want to do is point people toward a lot of the kind of orienting assumptions that we make about disciplines that I think a lot of people shared about, especially in the ways that they learn being both formal and informal, tacit and explicit. So that's one of the assumptions on page 3 of the slides that we make about how people learn within disciplinary contexts. Some of the other things we've talked about maybe together is that disciplines have histories, right? That we enter at a particular point in time, whether it's Aikido training or learning mathematics, but we enter at a particular point in time and we learn that our disciplines have histories and that we're entering into learning at that particular point in time for us, but that this practice, this set of knowledge has gone on before us and will continue on after us in many ways. So that's a second assumption, that disciplines are cultural tools and ways of knowing that help us understand our world. So these are ways that we organize ourselves in order to explain the world to ourselves and others. And so that's a main orienting assumption of what we're doing, that disciplines kind of organize our thinking, organize who we are, organize our interactions. And those things, I think, were part of the themes that we heard coming up from people as well. Mm-hmm. And then I think one of the things maybe that didn't come up quite as clearly, but that I think is a really important assumption about what we're making and that is a part of the literature, is that disciplines have a particular kind of questions or content, a focus in content, and also they bring this way of doing things within a particular area. So there are strategies that one brings to developing knowledge and practices, and there are knowledge and practices themselves. So that's definitely something that we think about as an orienting assumption. I think Jerome Bruner, Schwab, Shulman, some of the references down at the bottom of the page will talk about how that's evident in the research literature over a period of time. So that's a big assumption that we're making as we kind of start this conversation. Mm-hmm. And then I think another piece that came out in our themes is that as we learn, we shape not only what we think and know, but who we are as people. So I think that what's interesting about that is that all of us, and I really appreciated Susan saying that she not only learned by formal training and years of experience, but by mentoring others, that we're always in this constant interaction that's relational in what we're doing. And we learn about who we are and who others are through this process. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the orienting assumptions that we have as we begin this discussion of learning in the disciplines. So anything else, Lindsay, that you want to add?
Only that I just, the examples were great in hearing, in the talk about Aikido, the talking about the why, you know, talking about the art and what it is and how it works. And in the example from the math, you know, there's that element of the asking, you know, why does this work, you know, and taking up those, you know, what are the assumptions within mm-hmm. this discipline? And you know, and in the yoga example, you know, how you also go on to teach, as Leslie was saying, that it is relational and it is an ongoing and, you know, social process. So I think you guys actually made all of our points just through your examples.
Yeah. So, and I hope that you'll bring that stance as we, you know, continue to think about what it is it like to learn a discipline in a school context. So we're going to shift gears. Like, we learn disciplines in many different ways. Our work today and the work that we've done around promoting argumentation happens to focus on history and science in school-based contexts. So if you'll look at page 4,
Susan wants to get in.
So I just wanted to make one other point about practice. All of these things, everybody mentioned the role of experience doing it and practice at doing it. And one of the things that's often implicit is that this is practice in which we're actually getting feedback, either based on what our students are showing us about what they understand, or where there's a coach that might give you feedback. I mean, there's an important principle about practice, which is that if you don't get sort of corrective feedback to fine-tune how you're doing something, you don't make much progress. There's a great example of from, I think it's Thorndike in the How People Learn book that sort of illustrates this. But the role of getting input from somebody who can help you acquire a practice, either a coach or a teacher, somebody, etc., is really, really critical.
Totally agreed, Susan. That's an excellent point, that it is incredibly important to receive feedback. And one of the things that I think is critical about the feedback is to think about how that feedback might be different in different contexts and with different disciplines and in formal and informal, and how feedback is both direct and explicit, but also tacit in the ways in which you might receive feedback from the environment in trying to do something. I noticed, I think someone said they were an expert at gardening. So the feedback you might get might not be from another person, but from a plant that isn't particularly happy where it's been placed or something. So, mm-hmm. But the feedback is an incredibly important loop in developing those sets of expertise. So critical. And as we move, I think what we're going to try to do at this point is, yes, the plant dies. That's for sure. We don't want that to happen. But I think that thinking about the wide range of things that we've talked about, we're going to try to narrow the scope at this point to begin thinking about what might it be like to think about disciplinary learning in school context. So we've talked about this rich kind of environment and the many ways that we learn. But in school settings, one of the things that we've noticed is that it's often the content area itself, like the concepts and facts, that get explicitly addressed, and that the tools to generate knowledge in particular disciplines, or a term we're going to use to describe that is kind of the epistemologies and the strategies that people use to generate knowledge in those disciplines, those things are often hidden and not expressly discussed via feedback. They're left implicit in the work of schooling or absent entirely. So some of what we set out to do in the work that we were doing that you read today was to set up an opportunity for history and science learning in elementary school to be viewed not as sets of facts to be understood and reproduced, like those disciplines can often be represented to young students of science and history, but as bodies of living knowledge and practices that they are able to participate in, develop, revise, and change over time. So those are two really important pieces of the work that we did, was saying this is how business as usual typically happens, and this is how we want kids to have more access to the tools and strategies of developing knowledge and practices in the disciplines and providing that feedback, Susan, that you're talking about that process. So I think we're going to stop here and see if anybody has any questions about those kinds of assumptions. Does anybody want to jump in? We'll give you a second. If you say that you want to hop in the queue, go ahead and do that. If we don't see that, I think we're going to try to transition here then to thinking about the epistemic practice and the tool that we focused on in history and science with kids, and that is the tool of argumentation. And so we were bringing this notion that one of the most foundational ways that scientists and historians develop and make knowledge and practices within their fields is by using this process of argumentation. So if you look at page 5, we kind of ask a question, what is argumentation? And I don't know if people can see that, but we have a little cartoon that has two little people having a fun argument, right? Often the way kids think about the term argument, or using the NRC definition of argumentation as a mode of logical discourse whose goal is to tease out the relationship between ideas and evidence. So in many ways for kids, this distinction is really important because the knowledge that they bring about argumentation is really about the comic, but what we're trying to help them understand is this notion of argumentation as connecting claims and evidence. So that's a big part of what we are trying to do for them, for the students. And anybody have any comments or feedback, questions, feel free to jump in the queue and stop us, okay?
Okay, we'll assume we're making ourselves very clear, and or you're saving your questions for later, and which is fine to do. What we're going to do now is transition into a small activity, which you will find some prompt for on page 6 of your PowerPoint slide. And the title of that slide is called "What Do You Notice?" So what we would like everyone to engage in, either with a partner or by yourself, we've prepared a slide with two different examples of students in a research study promoting argumentation, which show kids engaging in the practice of argumentation. On the left side of the slide, which is slide 7, there's an example from science. And just to provide a very brief context, it's from a science unit called Sinking and Floating. And on the right side of the page, there is an example from history. And that was from a curricular unit about Rosa Parks and the civil rights movement. So those, just to provide a brief context of what those kids are talking about. But really, before we provide a lot of interpretation or analysis of what kinds of things we look for or see in those types of interactions, we want to get you engaged in thinking about what you think is going on and what you see as relevant in those clips. Okay, so there are some prompting questions on slide 6. What do you notice? What jumps out at you? Why do you think you notice that? I mean, here might be a place to think about your own disciplinary lenses and what things you tend to notice. What do you think it means? What do you think the students were trying to do? And if you've had experience working with elementary students, and these were sixth grade students, also just to provide that bit of context, how does this compare to what you might typically see happening in an elementary science or history classroom? Okay, and also before we send you off to have that discussion, we will forefront this by saying we're going to start with this sort of analysis and providing the big picture of what we've been looking at in our research and how we've analyzed data like this, and then work backward to explain how did we create the conditions that made these sorts of conversation emerge in the classroom discourse. Okay, so we'll give you about 5 minutes to check in with that slide on slide 7 to read through those and make your comments.
Okay, so we'll jump in with video. I found the left example, the science example, very interesting, because in comparison to what I think is normal teaching, here these students are trying to co-construct the rule why something is floating and why some other things are not. And especially there, like the Alex, he's saying sometimes it will float, and they all together see, well, if it should be a rule or a theorem, you should be able to say what happens. And you can't say, well, sometimes it's floating, sometimes it's not floating, but it has to be like very definitive what's going to happen with this object and what's going to happen with that object. And I think it's quite an amazing job they're doing, thinking about this by themselves. And I know that they have some scaffolding, I read that in the paper, but still it's quite impressive.
It seems to me one of the things that's interesting about what you pointed out is that from an epistemic point of view, that's not going to happen every time, right? A theory is the best account of the data. We know there's variation, and we know there's variability in the results you'll get whenever you try something. And so you got a conflict here between whether a theory has to be right all the time and account for all the data, or whether it has to account for most of the data, and whether or not you throw out a theory because one time it doesn't happen. So that is an interesting kind of window into what the epistemology might be.
Yeah, these are great observations. I'm taking notes. We'd love to hear from anyone else, either in the chat box or by jumping in the queue, what sorts of things you noticed, how you feel the students are resolving these dilemmas that they're facing with looking at the data or the evidence. So we'll jump off for just a minute. If anyone else wants to type in or get in the queue, we'd like to hear a few more. All right. Well, thank you guys for your comments on these. It's interesting to hear it reflected back to us after we're so familiar with this data and have been looking at it for a number of years together and making sense of it. But some of the things that you're noticing are quite relevant to the analyses that we did do with this data initially. Both of these examples, as many of you have noticed, involved what we came to call in our paper that you read for today as defining argument, that students were really grappling with the idea of, what does a theory or an argument within science look like? How is it constructed? What can be included? What can be left out? So what are the parameters around those types of issues in both disciplines? And we did choose these examples to be sort of comparative in that respect, to show that within science and within history, different types of issues about evidence and theories and the coordination of those two things were coming to the fore for students. So they are grappling with these questions. For example, in history, that a theory could have, or an argument in history could have multiple parts, and that they could both be true. And the conversations extended to also include issues of, if you have a theory but it doesn't match what you believe, do you have to include that as part of the theory? Or similar to in science, are there situations in which the data is so variable, do you include it or can you leave it out? Is it explained, does a different theory explain that? So students were very much active in this process. And, the teacher and the curriculum materials guided that process for them, but they were very much taking this on for themselves and trying to understand. And as I think, as Daniel said, to co-construct what are the rules. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these things did emerge just from their interactions, as going back to our plant example, right? Did the plant die? that itself and the materials sort of gave students that feedback that, and the feedback that they were getting in the questioning and the alternative arguments from their peers. Anything else we want to say about their comments, Leslie?
No, I think that I think what's so interesting is that you all noticed, right? They were really grappling with something that was beyond just the doing of the work, but really asking what that structure should be. And I think Susan alluded to the fact that this was really connected with some epistemic arguments that mm-hmm. they were trying to make. So I think if we turn, I think Lindsay was just referring to page 8 of our slideshow. We have the argumentation clusters that we used. We've now given you examples of one of those clusters, right, in defining arguments as theory-driven. From here, there are all sorts of other things we talk about in the paper, but we wanted to kind of link that particular example to the kinds of things that we discussed in the paper. But also, if you look on page 9, to the features of epistemic cognition. So one of the things that we found is that analyzing what the kids were doing in an emergent way, it also helped us to think about how does that align with what we know that scientists and historians are thinking about. So I know Clark Chin is coming on in a few weeks, I think, Susan, to give a webinar as well. And his work is very interesting around this. He's done and created kind of 5 different categories of epistemic thinking that help us kind of think about how disciplines are organized as well. So we saw that as kids were defining argument, that in many ways that maps on to page 9, Clark and his colleagues, their second kind of feature of mm-hmm. epistemic cognition, that they were thinking about how should knowledge be structured when they're thinking about whether or not a theory has to account for all of the data, even when there was an anomaly, or how are they making sense out of it? Is it an anomaly? Is it something that we just, can't explain at this point? How do they think about organizing that knowledge? And so that is definitely something that not only are sixth graders interested in, but it turns out that people who study actually how disciplines organize themselves are interested in those same sets of questions at a much more, you know, kind of professionalized level. Mm-hmm. But it was helpful to see, I think that Daniel mentioned this too, how the kids were actually dealing with stuff that may not be very typical for kids their age, but is also really reflective of disciplinary practice. Mm-hmm.
So going back just briefly to the slide 8, where it says argumentation clusters, Leslie and I were interested in talking a little bit about our process of how we sort of took these examples and took data from across four classrooms and sort of developed this coding scheme to account for the type of argumentation practices that students and teachers were engaging in together. And just to point out just very briefly, a few of the more common ones were like formulating arguments. The students were engaged in the work of building their own theories and historical arguments. Alternative arguments at the top left corner, where they are, learning to question each other and to come up with counter theories and argue back and forth on the merits of different theories. And so those were common. Those were the types of, in the defining argument that we've already talked about, the types of clusters that were very consistent and showed up across all of the classrooms as the types of practices that this curriculum and the research project allowed them to engage in. But really where it got interesting for Leslie and I as researchers, we had this whole beautiful paper written using these emergent clusters, and then we did discover Clark's article or paper on the epistemic cognition in the five categories. And those five components we found actually did map onto everything we were already finding in our data, and help to really clarify the ways and the different types of ways in which things students were doing with their teachers were epistemic. And all of five of those categories were accounted for and just proliferated throughout the discourse data that we collected from the classrooms. And interestingly, the thing that it shows that the epistemic lens helped us to see was really how students are able to distinguish between what goes on in history and what goes on in science, and maybe sometimes to be able to directly compare what those are, but at least within each discipline to make arguments and claims about the evidence that are disciplinary and reflect those practices of the larger discipline and what experts would be up to. So I think what we're going to do now is turn to what we said earlier, to backtrack a little bit on how did we promote and provide the experience for students to be able to do this. So maybe you can compare this to your own research projects or experiences you've had in classrooms, and just think a little bit about the design principles that help make such conversations and epistemic thinking possible among students. And I think Leslie's going to talk a little bit through on page 10 there about what those key ingredients are.
Yeah, so I think one of the questions is like how did students come to have these conversations in the first place? So we thought we would start with the conversations themselves and then try to unpack, as Lindsay's saying. So I think that this slide on page 10 gives you a sense of some of the basic background that we discuss in the paper, that the purpose of the research was really for us to understand the emergent argumentation practices and how that connected up with disciplinary epistemologies in science and history. And so we've given you like a little flavor of what that's like by using these examples. And then we had framing questions for the kids that were really critical in the units that they engaged. So we're going to talk a little bit about those. So we had a unit on why things sink and float. And the question was very simply, why do some things sink and other things float? And kids had to develop arguments to answer that question. And then in the history unit, it was a unit on Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott as the beginning of the civil rights movement in the U.S. And we had two driving questions in that unit. One was, where did Rosa Parks sit? And the second is, why did she stay in her seat? And the students used different sources of evidence, so that's the next piece of this slide, for each of these units. So in the sinking and floating unit, they used sets of experimental objects of varying size, shape, and material. And you'll see that on page 11 of your handout. We have just a picture of the sinking and floating objects that the kids used that allowed them to experiment with their ideas and to develop arguments for why some things sink and other things float. And then in history, we had an archive bin of 15 primary and secondary source documents. That's pictured on page 12 of your handout. It's a little hard to see. They're kind of thumbnails of the documents that the kids had, but you can see the description underneath about what each one of these documents was. So there were everything from textbook accounts to the actual police report and to newspaper accounts to photos and the Montgomery City Code for how bus drivers could behave in the course of driving and what the rules were about who could sit where on the bus. So these were all things that the students used as they began to try to answer their questions of where did Rosa Parks sit and why did she stay in her seat. So these are the materials that, that they received and supported their efforts. And then in addition to that, kind of those physical materials and the driving questions, we also had a set of kind of intellectual and social tools that kids were able to use. One is on page 13. We talked about it as a set of tools for thinking like a scientist and thinking like a historian. And so each of the units had three different practices that we introduced to the students. And you can see those on page 13. For the scientist, it was predicting and theorizing, summarizing results, and relating predictions, theories, and results. And then for the thinking like a historian, it's sourcing, which basically means understanding who wrote the source, when it was written, is it believable? How would you evaluate the credibility of a source such as this? And cross-checking, thinking about how do the sources actually cohere together to help us understand and explain the circumstances of why Rosa Parks stayed in her seat, for instance. And then imagine the setting. One of the things that we do know is that kids often have difficulty thinking about the past because they bring a kind of presentism. They're really, and this is also developmental, thinking about things from the perspective that they have, right? So thinking about what it was like in the past can also be difficult. So really supporting them to do the disciplinary work of imagining the setting at a particular historical point in time that might be different than the present time that they are accustomed to. So those are things that we thought about. We can see some questions. I'm going to try to read these to see if I can answer. Okay. So asking questions to clarify what they were looking at on the board.
That was from above, I think.
From above. Okay, I see. Okay, so what grain size do you think would be the ideal level of implementation for argumentation practices? Okay, so we can think about that. You know, is it classroom, department, or broader school culture? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I think is ideal, obviously, in classroom settings, using these kinds of tools at the classroom level, I think is really helpful. Mm-hmm. But the idea that certain practices, like thinking like a scientist or a historian, thinking about it as a cultural toolkit in a sequenced set of experiences for kids, clearly having something that was happening at the school or kind of the district level, even in some cases, I think would be tremendously helpful mm-hmm. to provide support and kind of accrue and build on the kinds of reasoning practices that they develop. That would be kind of ideal from our point of view.
Yeah, it actually, the question, I mean, can we just check all of the above, right? Because those would be great if we could do at all of those levels. But one of the interesting findings that came out of our study was that, you know, we were in three different schools working with four different teachers in the study, and they differed, as are the paper that we're currently finishing up and about ready to send out for publication, but they differed quite substantially in terms of some of their beliefs and practices in their own classrooms. And so our first paper really helped us to see, and it was a little bit of a surprise to us, how much of an impact the curriculum and not just the, you know, the physical curriculum, but also this cultural and intellectual toolkit that we were giving students really impacted and created very similar findings across classrooms, that there really was, even though these were individual classrooms within schools and participating in this project, the impact of the curriculum was quite substantial. Mm-hmm. and led to disciplinary conversations and practices among students. But then looking at, as Leslie was just saying, you know, when you have a culture within a school, a follow-up study, a longitudinal study that I did following this year of implementation and promoting argumentation, I followed two of the students to middle school. And these were two students who were active arguers and highly engaged in the conversations, such as the one that you read through already. And then I followed them sort of as their shadow into their middle school history, social studies, and science classrooms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the same opportunities weren't there for them in terms of making sense of the subject matter and the content on their own and formulating their own theories. And there was a great degree of frustration and also just awareness that, you know, I'm not allowed to think this through for myself in this context. So whenever we can provide opportunities for students to have that continuity, to learn the argumentation practices and then to extend it and build upon it and to see and to become those types of people who can think and argue in that way, of course, would be ideal.
So I see that Susan's asking about the implementation and whether or not we take you know, kind of fidelity and faithfulness to some implementation. And she asked who implemented, teachers or researchers. So actually this this research project went forward like a lot of learning sciences projects do, as a design-based research project that collaborated really deeply with the participating teachers, who helped actually define what curricular areas we were going to focus on from the beginning, and then helped participate in the design of the units themselves. So they were involved throughout the entire design process. And then in the classroom itself, primarily it was teachers implementing the curriculum, unless they were absent on a given day. And occasionally, as a result, the researcher who was documenting it on that day would then be teaching as well. But for the most part, it was primarily the teachers who were doing the work, and they were involved all throughout the process. And so, yes, it might explain the similarity of effects that we found, that the curriculum itself was something that was co-designed with them, and that the teachers had a good deal of support in developing and knowledge and use of even the materials. The materials, the unit plans that we put together were put together with teachers, the sequencing of everything we provided with them. So, yes, there was a good deal of similarity as a result. One of the things that I think is interesting about this, though, that we have to be really honest about, is that when we started this process, we did not expect to find out what we found. So as much as we're saying that the DBR process kind of allowed us to see this and kind of collaborate with teachers in a particular way, when it came to actually implementing it and documenting it, our experience on the ground was that the classrooms felt quite different from one another. And so we started the process of trying to understand whether or not that translated to different opportunities to learn around argumentation, which was the centerpiece of our work. And so we kind of expected that maybe there might be some differences given our feel for the classroom, if you will. But what we found actually was that there were more similarities than differences in the kinds of, in the range of things. And even if you look at some of the tables in the paper itself, that there weren't vast differences between the classrooms, but it still kind of made us puzzled, well, then why were we having the experience of the classrooms themselves as being so different from one another? Mm-hmm. And so there were some really important things, and that's the paper Lindsay is alluding to now. We started to think, actually, we need to write two papers. One is about the argumentation, which seemed more similar, and the DBR process does explain that, I think. But there was also this sense in which teachers took particular stances toward knowledge, another one of the epistemic categories that you see on page, I'm going to try to pull out, I think it was,
not the five categories.
Yeah, the five categories. What page is that?
Nine.
Page nine, again, the epistemic categories, thinking about the kind of epistemic stance that you take, that was one of the things that we noticed, that teachers took very different stances. So some of them, for instance, let me define what that means. So some of them would say things like knowledge is knowable and that we can figure out something in a particular area, or knowledge is we can't really develop a strong understanding. It's always up for revision. So the degree to which you can know truth or knowledge in a discipline seemed to vary across the teachers. And it was an epistemic commitment on their part that may have given us the sense that the argumentation opportunities were vastly different as a result, because that stance feels so strong when you're thinking about it. So that's the paper we're writing right now. It's about those kinds of epistemic stances that teachers take around that. And the other area, I think, had more to do with the epistemic virtues and vices and the ways in which kids were positioned as, like one of the teachers talked about the role of debate as being a really, really, really important part of developing knowledge, particularly in history. And she would use the words like the hot seat, being on the hot seat and being able to defend what you believe using the evidence from the archive bin was going to be critical, and that you were going to be positioned almost as you would be maybe in a court to defend your argument.
Or in a talk show.
Or maybe even, right, maybe even a talk show would be a better way to think about it, like an old 80s talk show, though, not the newer ones. But that was kind of the essence of what, and that was different than other classrooms. So we're noticing that it may be that these categories are not only good at explaining what we see kids doing, mm-hmm. but the ways in which teachers take up these things in interacting with the curriculum might help explain the differences that we saw so completely when we were in the classrooms at first. So we're reading another question here. In reading the examples, it made me wonder about the quality of classroom climate that would contribute to these kinds of conversations. There are relational values reflected here and how the kids are talking to one another and learning together. That would also be something that would vary across classrooms, but perhaps there are common themes.
Right. And so, and the thing that I think Leslie did not really speak to, which is funny because it's your own work, in terms of how we set the one of the tools that was part of this research project was including the intellectual roles that go along with this. And so in addition to just knowing how to think like a science and how to think like a historian, we assigned to students intellectual audience roles that helped to scaffold their participation in these conversations with one another. And of course, the teachers had their own tools and their own ways of organizing social dialogue and, you know, creating contracts for, you know, how to respectfully talk and listen to each other. I mean, we saw all of those things and those sort of nuances across the classrooms. But we did also bring that tool that Leslie had researched in her previous work of how, you know, you get students to engage with one another in dialogue. If one group's presenting, the students who are in the audience have a particular role. They're looking for particular types of arguments and making sure that it's all fleshed out. And so I think that really also accounts for and contributes to the, I think, what you're noticing here and how they're talking to one another.
Yeah. And I think it's an excellent point that the quality of a classroom climate and the norms and expectations and supports that are in place for kids to be able to engage in these conversations is critical. And in many ways, the teachers were using good collaborative learning processes and then we also brought the kind of disciplinary lens and how do you have conversations and kind of support these disciplinary practices to take hold in the classrooms.
So two new questions.
Should one vary the scaffolds according to the ability groups to bring about the desired discourse? So I would say that the approach that we've taken, and Lindsay, jump in at any point, is actually to group kids heterogeneously. And I know someone mentioned that their expertise was in ESL, in supporting ESL students. We also thought a lot about heterogeneity with respect to ability and academic performance, but also with language. And that was something we did intentionally. And we've talked a lot about how those heterogeneous groupings are actually really powerful and supportive, I think, mm-hmm. to the way kids learn in their small groups and how kids are positioned as learners. And we saw in multiple situations, kids are also, in addition to taking on the roles of asking each other questions during the conference presentations, they rotate whether or not they're reporting for their group or they're helping to register to present to the group, to the larger class, I mean. So they're working together. Sometimes you're the reporter. Sometimes we call the role that helped build the poster the scribe. And so, but you had to work together in order to decide what you were going to put down on paper because the kids who were reporting were going to have to do that. So we noticed in many ways the kids actually took those things quite seriously and positioned each other with competence with respect to that. So in some cases, it really meant kind of standing next to them, providing a kind of support for them and allowing them, when it was their turn to report, even in cases where kids felt more, sometimes it was maybe disposition or temperament, they were a little bit more shy. There were some kids who were learning English and new to the classroom in certain cases. But in every case, the kids really did seem to develop and support each other in that heterogeneity. So I would say actually that the heterogeneous groups were actually part of the reason why it worked so well. And it did create that kind of climate that we had in the classroom where everybody had things to say. And it was important to listen to each other. We've had other kids in other settings do things like, you know, we all know, right, that in classrooms, certain kids kind of take the floor readily and others can be shut out from access to participation. And I've noticed that actually especially with the scientists, the roles of thinking like a scientist that I've used over many years in many classroom contexts, that actually if you start to believe that your job is really to understand how people are making sense of claims and evidence, you have to really listen carefully to them and decide whether or not that maps onto what you've actually experienced or not. So you make opportunities on the floor for everybody to share those things because understanding that is critical to your own ability to evaluate your own understanding. And so for the kids, that the process itself created not only a good classroom climate and supportive social structure, but also the intellectual rigor seemed to be supporting that at the same time. So those things kind of went hand in hand in our experience. I don't know, Lindsay, if you have things
well,
you want to say
just,
about that.
Just to bring up some of the analyses that I did in my dissertation as well. So using the same data and just thinking about the different experiences of students within this project. So I took one of the classrooms and did a basically turn-by-turn analysis of both of those curricular units, which was a lot of coding. but looking at the different sort of emergent roles that students took throughout the process of, you know, developing theories, reporting out theories, asking questions from the audience, and sort of found that, you know, different kids had their different niche in terms of, you know, how they chose to participate. Some were great questioners, some loved to do the reporting, some were really good at providing sort of the counter arguments and coming up with those things. And so the more we looked at this data, the more we see possibilities for students with a wide range of interests and passions and proclivities and personalities to participate in ways that are relevant and meaningful to them as people. And we did find situations in which I know that I'm thinking particularly of one of the English language learners in one of the classrooms said she felt more comfortable in science because there were the, you know, the objects and she could do the testing and she could, you know, find the words to talk about that, where the history was something that was a little bit more difficult for her because, you know, all the reading and all of the text that she had to analyze to be able to make those arguments. So, you know, this this diversity of experience with, you know, how you present these types of curricula that are rich and complex. I mean, the more opportunities you're giving students to connect with in ways that are at the right level and meaningful to them.
Yeah. Okay, so we have another question. I would be interested in the feedback of the teachers after the units regarding the learning results, the class climate, and the execution of the school lessons. Do you have any impressions there?
Not recently.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
I think immediately following, they were very positive about, except for the fact, like, the one thing that they did say, I think that's important, is that this takes a lot of time. So the one thing that we did receive feedback about is that they participated in all aspects of this. I think they thought it was terrific in many ways. And I think they continued to use the units even after we stopped the study. But the one thing that they did say is that the amount of time that it was taking to do these units was significant. What were they? How many days? Like three weeks?
Yeah, it was the science was a 7-day and the history was 10 days.
Yeah.
Of about and a half to 2 hours of instruction. So,
it was a large amount
of time they committed to that also wasn't necessarily aligned with what they were supposed to be teaching that year.
Right. Even though they picked the content
area. So there was I think that was probably the biggest feedback that we got in terms of, you know, how do we make something like that sustainable when it, you know, they loved the way that students were grappling with the evidence and engaging in that process. But how do we do that on a shorter time scale?
Right.
I think were the questions they had.
And I think they did things like they modified the curriculum in one of the classrooms. They actually did a reenactment of the bus scene, doing that one. Mm-hmm. And so they also took the curriculum and expanded what we had maybe anticipated doing, in part because it was such a good experience for the kids, so much so that reenactment had kids thinking about what would the bus driver have seen, because the police report calls into question what's going on, and positions like of pictures, like where people are seated, whether or not that could actually be an actual reflection of where Rosa Parks sat or not. And it was all about like thinking about where the bus driver was, and when the kid who was the bus driver turns around, you can see what kind of a view that he would have had. So it was incredibly helpful what they did, but I also think they were really concerned about time, like a lot of teachers that pressed for. I think they loved the kinds of ideas that they were developing with the kids and felt like the kids got a tremendous amount out of the experience, but it took a lot of time.
So this is a really interesting question.
Okay. Did you find the teachers' own disciplinary backgrounds impacted the epistemic stance they took around argumentation? Do you think it is possible or desirable to support multiple representations of this practice for students in the classroom?
Interestingly, I think when we looked at, so the analysis that we're currently finishing up and getting ready to send off for publication looks at teachers' epistemologies and sort of what they draw from when they were presenting images of history and science to students in the classroom. And one teacher's background was in science and the other, I think, was more of a
political science.
Or
communications.
Yeah, and almost, it didn't really turn out that was the case, that's where they drew their epistemologies from. But there were other sources of things that they talked about. For instance, one teacher that we referred to before who talked about the hot seat and was really sort of framing up that vision of what it means to defend an argument had a long history of teaching debate units in her classroom and really looked forward to that all year. That was something that she planned for and sort of had in her own epistemology around those sets of experiences. And the teacher that had the scientific background was the one who really left those questions about knowledge and knowledge creation open for the students that, can we know the truth? You know, how do we know it? And really asked students to grapple with those really big questions about perspective and I don't know if I'm saying this very well, but
no, I think that you're, and especially with the teacher who was really leaving open whether or not truth could be known in science is a really interesting question. She herself had a background in, I think, anthropology and several other things. But I think she felt really strongly that to close down the idea that science is a process of revising over ideas over time was something that she felt really strongly that kids received maybe messages about this being a set of facts that you can't really engage with in any fundamental way. She actually maybe went to another extreme, kind of thinking about how you can't really know anything and that, you know, in any case, it would be hard to know for sure, right, for absolute certainty. So I think that maybe there was a kind of reaction to a concern about presenting these things as already closed questions. Mm-hmm. She presented them as constantly open questions.
But to go back to the question about multiple representation, I think that's a really interesting question that I don't think we've quite grappled with yet. We really have looked a lot at how the teacher's orientation toward these epistemic categories influenced the sort of the tenor of the conversation, like what the types of things students talked about and where they got in their knowledge building. You know, the teacher that said, you know, can we really know this and ask those questions all the time, they never came up with an answer. Whereas in another classroom, you know, it's like, we need to get an answer. We need to vote on one, or we need to decide by the end of this, and we all have to be able to say it and to repeat it. And at some point, you know, there is a final answer. And so even just those different orientations led to different, you know, goal, what we called epistemic aims or goals for the students as well. And so, you know, being that as a teacher in your own classroom, you bring an epistemic perspective to your teaching, I think we'd have to be really creative to think about how you represent other ways of thinking about that, because we all definitely bring our own bias into that process of how we think about knowledge and see the world. But I definitely like the idea of multiple perspectives whenever possible. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And it may have helped, actually, to have multiple perspectives represented by the adults in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Some kids found it really unsatisfying that she would not answer the question and claimed she didn't know, even down to, like, where Rosa Parks sat. Like, we know where Rosa Parks sat, right? Mm-hmm. And she even would say things like she didn't remember. Like, there was just a certain way that she was basically wanting to leave these questions wide open, both in history as well as science, for sure. Mm-hmm. And then, Susan, you're asking about debate, making things binary and maybe that not being helpful to the practice of history. I think that, you know, our hunch and our analysis would probably suggest the same things. And it also created a certain amount of tension among the kids where socially that, you know, so you had the intellectual experience of historically trying to kind of make the best argument given the evidence you have, right? And then you have the social dimension of that for certain kids where it worked maybe for certain kids to do that, but may not as well for other kids who were more reluctant to and very reticent to be viewed as somebody who was going to stand up and defend no matter what, right? You weren't going to change your ideas. So I think you're right. Like, part of what it means to argue in history is to be sensitive to how to adjust and shift with new ways of viewing the evidence. Mm-hmm. Whereas the idea of a hot seat made you a defender of a position rather than somebody who could hear out the ideas of others and those interpretations. So it definitely, I think, was a tension that we experienced in that.
Okay, so we'll stop. Yep.
And I wondered if you guys had any final thoughts you wanted to offer, or if anybody had any additional questions. I want people to have time to get all their questions out and then think about a sort of closing. There was one question that we sort of ask in standard of the presenters in these webinars, and that is, why do you think what you're doing is important to the learning sciences? And what recommendations would you make to students if they want to sort of incorporate some of what you are doing in terms of the kinds of questions or the methodology into what they're doing? So let's see if there are any more questions by people getting into the queue, if they have additional questions or typing them into the chat window. So we'll like take 15 seconds or so to see if there are more questions. And if there are, then Leslie and Lindsay can respond to those. Otherwise, let's move on to this other question about importance.
So if people have final questions, feel free to to jump in at this point. I think that we'll just point you to some summary questions and then answer the questions that Susan just posed as well. So I think that on page 15, we kind of identified two of the big takeaway messages that we've already talked about, so that we did find similar argumentation practices, but that it was a little bit of a surprise, and now we're kind of looking at this issue of teacher epistemic stance and kind of positioning kids with respect to some of those epistemic categories as a way to help us think about what the nuances were of that work. So that's kind of like the high-level summary of the particular study that you read for today. But we also, on page 16, wanted to be sure to talk about the fact that our work, this particular study, exists within a larger frame of work. And we never really set out to look at disciplinary thinking alone, but to explore disciplinary thinking as a space for students to emerge as thinkers and people. And so Lindsay and I wrote a paper, and actually it was the first paper on this project, was really about ideas of power in the classroom and how that was functioning not only in a social way, power in a social way, but power with respect to the discipline and thinking in a discipline in a way that is consistent with strong, sophisticated ways of thinking in history and science. So that was something that we really paid attention to and analyzed in that paper. And then I've written a book with another student of mine where we really kind of take the approach of looking at the idea that we're not just developing thinkers, we're developing people who put knowledge skills to use in particular contexts, and we really need to understand what that's like. So kids developing a sense of themselves and identifying with history and science is a big part of what we think about. So it's not just their disciplinary reasoning, but how they come to see themselves as scientists and historians. That's a big part of what we're doing. And we give you some URLs if you're interested in learning more about current work that we're doing that kind of spans the academic, social, and emotional learning. You can take a look at a new community hub here that's based at the University of Washington, but we collaborate with school districts, with community-based organizations called the 3DL Partnership, Innovations in Three-Dimensional Learning. So we've given you those things. That feel free to email either one of us if you have questions about any of the work that we're doing. We're happy to respond.
Just type in my email here too, okay, in case you don't have it.
Right. So Lindsay's typing in her email so that you'll have her email as well as mine.
No, wait, what is yours?
Leslie H.
Oh, yeah, okay.
so feel free to get in touch with us. And then we thought we would respond to Susan's questions as well. So Susan asked, like, how is the work that we're doing relevant to the learning sciences? And then what advice do we have for people who are interested in using this work? So I'll get started maybe, and then Lindsay, just jump in. So I think that the work that we're doing feels to me, as both a learning scientist and developmental psychologist, as some of the central work of our field. We focus on learning. We bring a sociocultural perspective and a disciplinary perspective to this approach. And as we talked about before, really thinking about kids within cultural systems coming to see themselves in particular ways. I think that's the work of our field, to kind of think about how people learn, how people develop as people within the context of their learning environments. And it's our job to kind of ask and answer those questions. And the other piece of our work that I think really connects up nicely is a lot of what we talked about with the method, the DBR, kind of DBIR signature method of the learning sciences, is something that we have used consistently across projects and really influences the way we think about the work that we do, you know, working shoulder to shoulder with practitioners. And, you know, Lindsay choosing to work in her role as kind of a researcher practitioner, I think is a really important part of the work that we're doing. And so as a result, I think that this is some of the most central work that we do in the learning sciences, interdisciplinary, bringing together people across settings and kind of using that methodology to do that.
Yeah, I think you said it.
So I don't know if other people have questions. Oh, they were asking about using the work. Do you have any insights about, like, how? So I think Lindsay was really particularly good at thinking about how to use work in the field to kind of help and position her own thinking and her own interests. And so I don't know if you have something you want to reflect on with respect to that or not. I don't know if we're late too. So just cut us off if we're going on.
Yeah, maybe that's what Susan's doing here. Let's check in and see.
Okay. So yeah, we are just about out of time, but I did want to mention that working cross disciplines, though very productive and useful for highlighting characteristics of your own discipline, is also really tough because you're negotiating different ways of approaching the world, different languages for describing the world, and sometimes the same language is used to describe very different phenomenon. And so we're involved in a big project here that's looking at both literature, history, and science, and trying to encourage and develop and test and build epistemologies in those three different areas. We're working we're not working with the same kids in each area or the same teachers in each area, which in some sense, some ways makes it harder, some ways makes it easier. But the challenges of negotiating a conventionalized set of terminology that this interdisciplinary community, as opposed to the disciplinary community, shares, takes a lot of time, effort, and work. So if you're getting into it, just be aware that you have this kind of commitment to build that common ground, in a sense. And that takes time. I want to sort of wrap up so people can go off to their 30 minutes past the hour of whatever hour it is and whatever time zone you're in, to whatever they have commitments to do, by thanking Leslie and Lindsay for a really stimulating webinar, and I think it's given us lots of food for thought. And I want to thank the participants at U of Washington, Dimitrios at U of N, where I'm not sure exactly where that is, and at the LMU, and of course the LMU folks for all of their phenomenal support for the technology. So thanks everybody, and see you next time.
Thank you, Leslie and Lindsay, and also Susan for the facilitation. It was a great webinar. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody. Thank you so much for great questions. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.
Yep, thank you.